Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with concerns within the military that President Trump's 4th of July military parade tomorrow in front of the Lincoln Memorial will put military personnel in a situation where they are violating Defense Department guidelines prohibiting soldiers, sailors, and airmen in uniform from engaging in political activity. Lawrence Korb, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss how the private concerns of military chiefs about Trump's 4th of July military parade are in dramatic contrast to Trump's claims that, quote, the Pentagon and our great military leaders are thrilled to be doing this. And while Trump is billing this as our 4th of July salute to America, it is already looking like a political rally in his re-election campaign, with Trump tweeting out today, quote, we have the greatest economy anywhere in the world. We have the greatest military anywhere in the world. Not bad. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee is handing out tickets to big donors as the National Park Service diverts funds to pay for the event. A new Gallup poll finds that American pride and patriotism has hit an all-time low, with only 45% of Americans saying they felt extremely proud, down from 70% feeling extremely proud in 2002. Then we'll speak with Stephen Kinzer, an award-winning foreign correspondent who has written extensively about U.S. interventionism in All the Shah's Men, Bitter Fruit, and the brothers John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their secret world war. He joins us to discuss his article at the Boston Globe, In an Astonishing Turn, Soros and Charles Koch Team Up to End U.S. Forever War Policy, and whether there will be a rethink of fighting losing wars, which appear not to matter as long as we maintain the global threat perception that justifies the bloated defense budget and feeds the military-industrial complex. Then finally, with the Republican minority in the Oregon State Senate returning from their hideouts in Idaho, now that they have successfully killed a climate bill they did not have the votes to stop by denying a quorum, we will speak with Anthony McCann, a professor of creative writing at the California Institute of the Arts, whose latest book just out is Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. He joins us to discuss the militia movement in the liberal blue state of Oregon and the role far-right militias played in having the state police shut down the Oregon State House due to credible threats of militia violence. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Thank you.
So, Larry, what do you make of this parade tomorrow? It breaks an American tradition. Presidents themselves usually lay low on the 4th of July to let the American people, all American people, celebrate this national holiday as they wish and feel good about each other normally. It's one of the least divisive days. I've experienced it a number of times out here. They do fireworks at Santa Monica College, and it's just wonderful the way people are so nice to each other and everybody's having a good time. But a lot of people aren't happy about what Trump is doing, and a lot of people inside the military aren't happy, I'm told. What are you hearing?
Well, very, very definitely the military is not happy. I think one of the ways it's shown, a lot of the top ranking military officers like General Milley, who's the Army Chief of Staff, who's going to become this month the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he's got other plans. I think if the enlisted people were allowed to, they would say they had other plans too, to do some of the things you're talking about. But obviously they have to show up. But the military is very concerned that this politicizes them, because normally presidents don't speak at this thing. No matter when Trump speaks, it's always political. And so they're going to be part, you know, they're going to be thrown into the political process.
Well, Trump's, of course, saying that the Pentagon brass are thrilled. That's what he said on Tuesday.
Well, I know he's saying that, but I can tell you they aren't. As I say, just take a look and see what top-ranked military leaders show up. That'll give you an indication. Obviously, he's going to say that. You haven't heard any comment, public comments, from any of the, you know, the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the heads of the individual services, plus the chairman and vice chairman. None of them had said, gee, this is really good. We think it'll, you know, improve the military's reputation or help us with recruiting. You haven't heard them say a single thing.
Well, indeed, hasn't there been a memo circulated in the Pentagon expressing concerns about the nonpartisan nature of the military and how they want to try and maintain that in spite of what Trump is doing?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, one of the great traditions going back to our 4th of July is that the military is non-political, because we saw how, you know, many leaders of countries would use the military to take and keep power. So we separated that. Only the Congress can declare war. The president is the commander in chief. But theoretically, he can't send the troops to war without Congress and the American people. And he can't get them any weapons. Congress has to, you know, decide what weapons they can have and keep and what bases are open.
So this is a horrible break in tradition, but what's it going to look like? I mean, we know that the president is a kind of cheesy discount celebrity. He's sort of crass and embarrassing, frankly. And what kind of a parade is this? We've seen pictures of the tanks on rail cars, but they can't chew up Constitutional Avenue, can they, with those heavy treads?
Well, they can chew it up. That's the problem. They'll cause problems. You know, back after we did so well in the first Gulf War and we had those parades, it destroyed a lot of it really caused a lot of problems for those streets, which, being a resident down there, I can tell you, you still see the bumps in the road and everything like that. Now, that was a parade to celebrate basically a victory, you know, which we worked with the rest of the world and to try and overcome the bad feelings and the hangover from Vietnam. But and then you saw Colin Powell was there along with the president. He was then the chairman. So that was different, and that was to celebrate, you know, a real important victory in the Middle East. This time, what are we celebrating other than, yeah, it's the birth of the country, but really we're celebrating Trump. And the other thing is, it's the Republican National Committee that's given out the tickets to people to, you know, hear Trump's speech and see these the best seats.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So, given that the tanks will, it wouldn't make sense for them to be on flatbed trucks, would it? I mean,
no, it wouldn't. They're on flatbed trucks to get them to the site of the parade. They set them up on rail cars, and then they, you know, had flatbed trucks. And the whole thing's been a disaster. Some of the trucks couldn't get under the bridges on the road. And, I mean, it really is just something that's going to cause all kinds of, I think, political problems for our military, as well as, is this going to be very expensive? And who's going to pay for it? We've already seen the National Park Service take money that they would have done, you know, to maintain some of the parks out west to divert it for this event.
So we were talking earlier about some of the discontent in the military. How did they feel? Did you get any feedback about what happened when the White House ordered the U.S. Navy to cover up the stern of USS John S. McCain so it was hidden from view from Trump when he was visiting Japan? That was just recently. And this feels like a similar situation where the military are being sort of dragooned by the White House. I mean, if he orders the Joint Chiefs to stand beside him on the stage tomorrow at the Lincoln Memorial, I might add, they can't very well refuse their commander-in-chief, can they? I mean, you were saying earlier that maybe some of them have found excuses not to show?
Oh, very definitely. And you got to remember with the McCain, they gave that order, but the admiral over in Japan wouldn't do it. And he refused to implement it. And I think basically they, you know, if they were ordered to stand next to him at, you know, basically what's a political event, they would they'd turn it down. And I think that would create a real crisis. But I know, as far as I know, to today when I checked, none of them said that they were coming.
Well, the tanks, you're saying, have had problems just getting there. You talked about the cost, Lawrence Korb. Apparently, the Navy's F-35s, which are going to be flying over tomorrow along with the Blue Angels, they're flying all the way from Lemoore in California, in the Central Valley. I mean,
well, that's right. That's where the Navy has its main F-35. You know, the new sophisticated fighter is out there, and they're just beginning to, you know, put it into the fleet. On the East Coast, you had a lot of the older versions, FA-18, E's and F's. But that's right. That's another cost because obviously you didn't. Well, you know, station them there because they're more concerned about, you know, China's military actions in the Pacific, and so that's where they're there to deploy to the Pacific.
Well, you've also got the Apache helicopters coming in from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. You've got the Blue Angels; they're actually flying in from Pensacola, Florida, and then you've got the B-2 bombers. They're coming in from Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. So a lot of jet fuel on the taxpayer's dime.
Well, no doubt about it. And see, you got to remember that most of our bases in this country are in the South and West. We don't, I mean, we have Fort Myer here, but it's more of an administrative base than anything else. Andrews Air Force Base is a lot of, you know, for flying overseas, but you don't have any operational squadrons there. And that's right. And so obviously that's something that you didn't anticipate in your budget. And unless you get a supplement, you're going to have to cut down training, for example.
And that's your job, wasn't it?
I mean, when I was in manpower installations and logistics, we had responsibility for readiness, and you know that's what we call the operations and maintenance budget. And when you do that, you anticipate, you know, so many training exercises and so many out flying hours a month, and obviously the deployments. Well, this wasn't planned, and so it's going to have to come out somewhere unless you get a supplement from Congress, which I don't think you will. You're not going to get a supplement from the National Park Service and the District of Columbia is wondering, they're going to send the federal government a bill, they said, after this is over.
Well, presumably, if the tanks tear up Constitutional Avenue, that's going to be a hefty bill.
Well, it will. It will. I mean, to, you know, do the repairs. And so, and don't forget, you had to pay to get those tanks up here to begin with.
So there's an interesting poll, Lawrence Korb, that Gallup just did, that finds that pride and patriotism is dwindling in this country, and that they've fallen. In 2018, 47% Americans felt extremely proud. This year, it's down to 45%. In 2001, just before the September 11th attack, the Gallup poll said that 87% of Americans were feeling proud of America, and a further 55% extremely proud. And then after the Twin Towers fell, American pride dramatically rose, with 69% and 70% feeling extremely proud. But then, since then, with the following the Iraq War, etc., and it's just going down and down and down. So this is a bit of an irony, isn't it? On a day that we're supposed to celebrate pride and patriotism, collectively, we are losing a sense of pride. And frankly, just speaking as an individual, I just find it so shameful that this country, in our name, this government, is mistreating these young kids on the border. I mean, they're just in our custody. You know, the Bible talks about the parable of the Good Samaritan. This is just, I don't know whether that's a factor, but it is ironic, don't you think, that Trump is trying to gin up this phony pride and patriotism, when the reality is that out there, throughout the land, it's a dwindling sense of pride.
No doubt about it. He's the only president, since we've been doing these polls, whose popularity rating has not risen above 50% at some time in his first couple of years in office. You're not only what's happening with the border, what he said about Muslims and countries in Africa. You remember he called them the S-word, countries. And then, of course, basically, you know, the people keep track. I mean, he's had 10,000 false statements. He's annoyed our allies and friends. And so, yeah, I mean, people are not, this is not the country we were. We used to be welcoming, you know, to people in other parts of the world, and we wanted people with all different ideas and faiths and beliefs in our country. And, you know, when I deal with people in the military today, you know what they tell me they're fighting for? Each other, not the country. Wow. And that's really worrisome because, you know, I can remember my days when I was in the service back in the 60s. We thought we were doing something. We found out Vietnam, they weren't honest with us. But the fact of the matter is, when we got there, we thought we were, you know, defending freedom and democracy.
So there's been a lot of criticism also that Trump's recent trip abroad to the G20 and to the DMZ and on the border between North and South Korea, how much it featured his own daughter, who was, again, that is the trappings of more sort of family-run despotic regimes, dictatorships, not unlike, for example, the dictatorship in North Korea. That's unsettled a lot of people, too. So there is, I think, a great deal of evidence that this president simply doesn't understand the norms of American government and really sees himself in a different way from our presidents. Because my understanding is that the tradition for American presidents is to lay low on the 4th of July and let the American people have a good time. And by laying low, they ensure that it is non-political, that it's non-partisan.
Oh, very definitely. I've been, you know, to several of those things on the Mall. I'm not going this year, I can tell you that. Yeah, but I've been to several of them. Yeah, and it was a day to celebrate, you know, this country, and you would sing the patriotic songs. You didn't have any politicians there at all, you know, trying to take, you know, credit for it or using it for their own purposes. But again, I mean, this is basically going to be a campaign rally if Trump acts like he normally does. And again, you know, with this family, using his daughter and his son-in-law to, you know, when he goes to North Korea, he didn't have his national security advisor. Now, I'm not a big fan of John Bolton's, but again, he is his own national security advisor. He's the one who should have been there.
And Pompeo also got shafted.
Right. I mean, John Bolton was sent to Mongolia.
Right. Well, it is an amazing time. I guess we'll just have to see what happens tomorrow. I expect it's going to be pretty cheesy.
I'm afraid so. And hopefully, you know, we can get beyond this. And I think it's very good with the polls that you talked about and a lot of the way the military, been an awful lot of pushback over here against it. And I think that sends the right message.
Well, Lawrence Corbett, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, good to be with you again, Ian. Take care.
You too.
Have a good Fourth.
Thank you. Same to you. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the strange bedfellows George Soros and Charles Koch teaming up to end U.S. forever war policy.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna do the war no more. Ain't gonna do the war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside. Down by the...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Kinzer, an award-winning foreign correspondent who served as a New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as the Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and is the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow, and Bitter Fruit, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. And his latest book is Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, In an Astonishing Turn, Soros and Charles Koch Team Up to End U.S. Forever War Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Kinzer.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And just reading the titles of the books that you've written, it's pretty clear that you have a pretty strong idea of U.S. interventionist foreign policy in the post-war era. Has anybody actually done a kind of inventory of whether or not all of this stuff ever worked? I mean, here we are literally on a hair trigger with Iran, the possibility of a third of the world's energy supplies being cut off. And if a shooting war breaks out with Iran, it'll be a hell of a lot worse than even Iraq and Afghanistan. But so often you hear, particularly from the Iranians, they go back to Mossadegh and the coup against the government of Iran back in 1952. So before we get to what it seems like a hopeful sign of these strange bedfellows, or these odd bedfellows, George Soros and Charles Koch getting together to end endless forever wars, is there a sense anywhere, except apart from the full body of your work, that gives us an idea of whether any of this stuff was worth it, particularly these CIA interventions?
Actually, there have been a number of studies about what was the long-term effect of American interventions in the politics of other countries. There have been, by various counts, some 60 of these, roughly, since the end of the Second World War. I suppose you can change your definition and then get the number wherever you want. However, there have been some careful studies, including one in a recent book called Covert Regime Change, in which the scholars have tried to put together quantitative analyses, a little different from what I do. My books tell stories of what happened in these interventions. But now we're getting to a more sophisticated point in a way where people are going through them one by one and trying to come to some conclusions. And among the conclusions they're reaching is that the operations almost never succeed. They don't bring democracy. They don't bring peace. They often don't bring better relations with the United States over any sustained period of time. And in many cases, the regimes that we installed are afterward overthrown violently by people who are much more anti-American than the government we first intervened to overthrow. So these interventions tend to, I think, make some American leaders feel good. Americans are very action-oriented. Americans really don't like to think about things. We like to do things. And I love that quote from George W. Bush, "I don't do nuance." That's so classically American. So I heard President Trump say recently, when asked if he had an exit strategy for a possible war with Iran, he said, "I don't need an exit strategy." That is also so classically American. I think we've always had this sense that since we are the United States, we can control all events. And therefore, we don't need to do all these boring things like think about after we invade Iraq, what might happen and what should we be prepared for? No, we're America. We don't have to think about that. And that is so wrong that it's gotten us into so much of the trouble we're in the world today.
Well, it's pretty clear that the blowback from the Dulles brothers is the idea that they used the green to fight the reds in the Middle East by stimulating Islam. And the, as far as I know, the mosques were absolutely dormant in the Middle East up until that project to use religion to combat communism and its encroachment into the Middle East. And we, of course, we know about the blowback from Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. But we also have at the moment this so-called border crisis, which the president is demagoguing. I'm not sure he wants to solve it. But he certainly is beating the drum about this invasion coming from the south. A lot of it's coming from Guatemala. And there again, Guatemala, I think, is a test case in what we're talking about, isn't it? Could you trace the getting rid of Arbenz, who was a, you know, like a social democrat, he wasn't a communist, for that stifling of democracy back then in 56, I think it was, to the current situation? Is there some lineage there in terms of our intervention?
Yeah, to put this in perspective, up until the Second World War, the United States tried to intervene in and control the politics of other countries through the old-style method, which was invasion. You just land troops on their shores, and you get at the capital, and you fire the president, you put in the guy you want. After the Second World War, that was no longer possible. There was a new force in the world. That was the Red Army, the Soviet Union. And you never knew whether if you landed Marines on the shores of Angola that maybe the Red Army would show up. And the next thing you know, you're spiraling into a confrontation that could lead to a nuclear war. So we had to find another way to work our will on other countries and depose governments we didn't like. And that's when we entered the era of covert action. The CIA was created in 1947 and given that responsibility. In fact, the CIA was a very secretive and mostly unknown organization for much of the 50s. And I have in my biography of the Dulles brothers a wonderful story where somebody comes up to Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, at a cocktail party in Washington and says to him, so what is the CIA actually? And he had a great answer. He said, think of us as the State Department for unfriendly countries. So in those days, two countries that the Dulles brothers focused on first were two countries whose leaders had actually caused great harm to their legal clients when they were back at the international law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. And those countries were Iran and Guatemala. Both were ruled by governments that were democratically elected. But the leaders of those two countries, Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran and Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, committed what we've always considered a cardinal sin, and that is they put the interests of their own country ahead of the interests of the United States. These countries both were sitting on valuable resources. In the case of Iran, it was oil. In the case of Guatemala, it was agricultural land, most of which was controlled by a powerful Boston firm, United Fruit. So by being nationalists and by promoting the interests of their own countries, Mossadegh went ahead and promoted the nationalization of the oil industry. And Arbenz promoted the land reform law that included a provision saying that United Fruit, being the largest landowner in the country, would have to sell off lands that it didn't use. And those lands would be taken by the government and given out to poor peasant families. So in both cases, we intervened with the CIA. These were the first two times that the United States overthrew a government by covert means, by the CIA. So Iran, 1953, Guatemala, 1954. Now, you look at the crisis that we're in with Iran, and you can trace it all the way back definitely to the 1953 coup. Iran was on the road to consolidating a real democracy. And if we had allowed that to continue and allowed for the emergence of a seriously democratic state in the heart of the Muslim Middle East, I can hardly imagine how different the Middle East might look now after all these decades. Instead, the opposite happened. Guatemala, similar things happened. After we overthrew the democratically elected government, installed the military leaders, there was great opposition, an attempt to go back to democracy. The United States would not permit that. In 1960, a group of military officers tried to overthrow their government. They failed. Then they ran up into the hills. A guerrilla war began that lasted for 30 years in Guatemala, killing some 200,000 people, mostly unarmed Mayan Indians. And that was more people than were killed in political violence in all the rest of Latin America combined during those 30 years. Guatemala has never really recovered from the horror of the violence that was set off by the American coup of 1954. And there's no doubt that the inability of Guatemala to develop and to ever even get back to the democracy that they had before 1954 is a decisive factor in the degradation of that state. It's spiraling down into almost failed state status, and as a result, the outpouring of refugees who want to leave.
And it is, for all intents and purposes, a narco state to boot. And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, who's an award-winning foreign correspondent who served as the New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as the Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow and Bitter Fruit, and the brothers John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. And his latest book is Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, In an Astonishing Turn, Soros and Charles Koch Team Up to End U.S. Forever War Policy. So let's get into your article and this extraordinary, these strange bedfellows teaming up to form a think tank named after John Quincy Adams, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. On Independence Day in 1821, John Quincy Adams declared that the United States, quote, goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. And that, of course, those words do seem to fly in the face of what we're going to be witnessing tomorrow on the Mall in Washington, D.C., with a military parade. But the issues that we've been talking about, interventionists and the interventionist foreign policy and blowback, is so much alive and well, this debate. Just in the recent Democratic presidential debates, there was an exchange over Afghanistan where a veteran, a major in the army, Tulsi Gabbard, basically said, you know, I've been there, done that, seen it, it's not working, let's get out. And Congressman Ryan being basically arguing the traditional U.S. foreign policy argument that we can't cut and run. So don't you think this is one of the most welcome things that's ever happened to U.S. foreign policy? Isn't this the 900-pound gorilla in the room? I mean, we've been trying to do an inventory on what has worked and what hasn't worked. What do you see in terms of what are your expectations for this new think tank?
The United States foreign policy went way off the rails after the end of the Cold War. We were entering a new era, but rather than readjust to a more peaceful world, we insisted on pushing ourselves into Eastern Europe, into the Middle East in ways, in some ways that were even harsher than we did during the Cold War. We've now gotten to the point where we've spent literally in the trillions of dollars on our foreign wars in the Mideast. We now maintain over 800 military bases around the world. And the grand total of foreign military bases by all other countries is 30. So we have more than, well, you can do the math yourself. We are the number one aggressive force in the world. Now, there's a big constituency for this policy. It makes lots of money for arms makers. Those arms makers then set up factories in the congressional districts of key legislators so that the legislators can't vote to end those programs without throwing their own constituents out of work. They also contribute lavishly to political candidates. The mainstream of the Democratic Party and the mainstream of the Republican Party have been strong supporters of this forever war project. So has much of the press. And quite importantly in Washington also are the think tanks. So these think tanks also are the ones that promote or churn out the intellectual basis and the arguments for constant war and intervention and massive defense budgets. And that counts both the so-called liberal and the so-called conservative think tanks. Some are traditional neocon. Others are more liberal interventionist, you might call it. But there is no substantial think tank in Washington that's questioning the whole basis of this project and trying to say we shouldn't be thinking about where to make war next and where the next threat is coming from. Actually, we're quite safe. Let's not exaggerate threats. Let's use our money at home and let's withdraw from those foreign wars. So the absence of that voice in Washington is what has led a group of scholars and activists to try to put together a think tank that would combat this orthodoxy. And that's what the Quincy Institute intends to be. They do have these kind of odd bedfellows. Charles Koch, of course, famous libertarian who wants to dismantle the social state in the United States and also is the head of a large corporate empire around the world. And George Soros, on the other end of the political spectrum, would consider himself very liberal, also has been involved in interventions through promoting so-called civil society projects that aim to overthrow governments in places like Georgia and Ukraine. But I think both of them now have come to the conclusion that we need to think about a different approach to American foreign policy. What would that be? Well, that's what this Quincy Institute is going to try to answer. What is the larger intellectual framework for a new kind of foreign policy? We do have outbursts of anger in the United States at particular episodes of our foreign policy. Most recently, for example, our war, the war we're supporting that Saudi Arabia is waging in Yemen. So people get very angry about that, and there's activism, and there are demands to stop. But then, after the Yemen episode will be over, that fades away. So the goal of this institute is to tie these episodes all together and come up with a larger framework that would be a counterbalance to the overwhelming power and authority of the interventionist mass in Washington. It's a promising start. It's still small compared to other think tanks. It's just getting underway. We'll have to wait some time to see if it can actually have an impact in the Washington morass. But it's an encouraging development because it breaks away from a kind of stultifying orthodoxy that has been essentially the only voice being heard in Washington on foreign policy.
So do you think that it can create a new debate in the sense that, you know, we are spending more on defense today than we did at the height of the Cold War when we had a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us out off the map in a half an hour. And the best we could do would be to wipe them off the map as well. And yet we're spending more and we don't have any enemies except, you know, the remnants of ISIS that are being, they're basically in a concentration camp that the Kurds are overseeing. So that's an extraordinary phenomenon. And can you broaden it out a little bit? If indeed the military budget is a form of military Keynesianism and in effect right-wing welfare, for the want of a better description, there is also other right-wing welfare like agribusiness, et cetera. So is there a way to make the argument or to turn the argument around and say, look, you know, there's no point in having these gold-plated military, you know, equipment. Timex is just as useful as a Rolex. And, you know, we'll never be able to have health care. We'll never have free education as they do in Europe. All the stuff that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about.
I think you're right. This is the great center, I think, of what's going to be emerging during this political debate of 2020 for the presidential campaign. Most of the candidates are embracing ambitious and expensive projects like the ones you mentioned. Free community college for everyone, forgiving loans, Medicare for all. Nobody ever asks the question when you want to start a war and it costs $100 billion dollars, where are you going to get the money? That's never on the table. But every time you propose an expensive social program, the howls go up, it's too expensive, we don't have any money to pay for it. So where do we get the money? I think the answer is so obvious. It's staring you right in the face. It's the 800 military bases and the almost trillion-dollar defense budget. There is a huge amount of money to be saved if we stop trying to control the world in ways that not only harm the countries we target, but actually in the end wind up undermining our own security. So we weaken ourselves doubly by this interventionist foreign policy. We weaken ourselves in security. For example, our invasion of Iraq probably cost us more military power than anything we've done in modern history. And at the same time, while we weaken our own security through these interventions, we're also robbing our own people of the resources they need to live the kinds of lives that the government and the country are rich enough to provide them with. So I think those are the themes that this Quincy Institute is going to start hitting on. And maybe we'll get to the point where these points are being made not only on Los Angeles Public Radio, but actually in congressional offices in Washington by people who really know their way around the Washington ecosystem. If that's true, the beginning of this Quincy Institute could begin to change the terms of debate in Washington. And that's something that's urgently necessary, both for the United States and the rest of the world.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking Times Bureau Chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as the Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow and Bitter Fruit, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles and Their Secret World War. And his latest book is Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, In an Astonishing Turn, Soros and Charles Koch Team Up to End U.S. Forever War Policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and now that the Republican minority in the Oregon State Senate returned from their hideouts after having successfully killed a climate bill, we'll look into the role that militias played in this standoff.
Southern Empire, the newborn of a hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triumph, an articulate liar.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot his..."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anthony McCann, who's a professor of creative writing at the California Institute of the Arts and the MFA program of the University of California, Riverside. He's the author of the poetry collections Thing Music, I Heart Your Fate, Moon Garden, and his latest book just out is Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthony McCann.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. And just recently I interviewed The Guardian's correspondent in Portland, Oregon, about the standoff in the state legislature, about where the Republican senators went off and hid out in Idaho in order to deny a quorum where the Democrats have the supermajority in both the House and Senate, and they and control the governorship. There was a dimension of the militia movements in Oregon, with the Oregon 3%ers apparently offering their services, if that's the right word, to protect
Idaho,
a Republican.
Idaho 3%ers too.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of them. Yeah.
So I want to get to your book, and which is largely about the Bundys and the big standoff at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. But what kind of role did they play in this drama, which now is over? The Democrats have to kill the bills, and it's pretty extraordinary in a deep blue state that a minority of a minority could pull this off. But What's the fallout here? Is there really a dimension in terms of the work that you've been doing and the groups that you've been studying in Oregon?
Not a direct dimension, as was reported a little bit hyperbolically in places like Esquire over the last week, and on Twitter and on like Rachel Maddow. More, I'd say more indirectly, what you see is actually rhetoric that's associated with the kind of rhetoric that was coming out of some militia type people who participated in some of the Bundy situations at Malheur and also in Nevada, though not usually from the Bundy, not from the leadership of the Bundy group so much, but definitely coming from some of the people associated with them, coming now from an actual Republican legislator who is not a militia person, as far as I know. One senator, Republican state senator in Oregon, Brian Boquist, actually, when the Republicans decided to walk out to block the quorum for the bill, as you were just talking about, he actually told the Oregon State Police Superintendent that they should, it's a very colorful quote, that the state police should send bachelors when they came for him and come heavily armed, because he would never be a political prisoner in the state of Oregon. Because to him, the idea of being returned for the vote was being a political prisoner. And it turns out that guy, he's a veteran. I think he's also I saw Oregon Press about this, but I haven't confirmed it myself. But I believe he also has a long career as a professional paramilitary, so the whole thing seemed a little startling. And that's when some of the militia people, you know, basically got on social media or got whoever they could get to talk to them to say, like, we'll support this guy, right? We'll defend them, because they were envisioning yet another standoff situation. They like those kind of constitutional, what they think is a constitutional standoff, where they protect someone from being forced to do something unconstitutional, or, you know, they stand up against tyranny, but their offers were not accepted. It's typical a lot of those militia groups to try to get attention whenever they can. One of the people who did speak up, Eric Parker of the Idaho 3%, he was at Bundy Ranch. He is the guy in one of the most famous pictures from Nevada, lying on Interstate 15, aiming his gun through a crack in a Jersey barrier. And he was at Malheur, but he decided that he did not join Ammon Bundy in the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, because he felt that they didn't have the support of the local sheriff and of the family that Ammon was standing up for in Harney County, Oregon. But his group did stick around after that and kept trying to insert itself into the drama, very much like what happened last week, including going out to one of the press conferences on the refuge that Ammon Bundy and his friends started having every day. There was a ton of press there, so they had plenty of coverage every day for their 11 a.m. press conference. And those militia guys went out there one Saturday, all tacked up, like body armor, long guns, hijacked that press conference basically to complain that Ammon had hijacked their movement. And basically one guy actually said, we're playing a very significant role. And then he never really explained. That was the leader at that time of the Idaho 3%. A guy named Brandon Curtis, but then he never really explained what that role was. They said they were going to be a buffer between the federal government and the occupation, and then they left. And so I saw that news story about the militia very much like what happened in that particular hijacking of that press conference. But the thing that happened in Oregon is it's alarming for anybody who cares about climate change getting passed, both because of the resistance of the Republican Party, but also because it turned out in the end, the Democrats actually never had enough votes to get the bill passed. So the whole thing was a very confusing political drama. There's definitely a lot of anti-climate change bill funding involved, including some going to some Democratic senators in Oregon. And there's also just a huge problem with the issue of the impact of such bills on poor, struggling rural communities. I think a lot of people felt that, you know, in the rural areas where the work in the forests has already declined so much, because of what someone like me tends to see as, you know, important environmental regulations, but sometimes maybe deployed in ham-fisted ways or not. You know, these are struggles that have been going on for a very long time. But there's been a lot of work lost in those areas. Unemployment is really high. Communities have been devastated. And sometimes bills like these have a disproportionate effect on people already struggling in those places. So I think we could also see in Oregon what something like a yellow vest movement might look like here. And that shows, too, Oregon is not exactly, it's a blue state, but it has, it can be a little bit purple. And especially when it comes to issues about the loss of work in rural areas.
Right. And well, it's certainly purple turning blood red in these meeting melees that take place in Portland on a regular basis between the Antifa people on the left and these militia guys on the right. Well, since you've spent so much time covering the Bundy occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and written about it, of course, in your new book just out, Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff, Anthony McCann, there's a couple of questions that I've had for the longest time. One of them is, and this just relates across the board, even in countries like Hungary, why is it in countries where you have a white majority tend to be completely isolated from issues involving immigration and multiculturalism? That's where opponents of immigration and multiculturalism are the greatest. I mean, there's virtually no Muslims in Hungary, but it's become a kind of paranoid national policy, and it seems to reflect that. That seems to be reflected also in these rural standoffs. But the other thing about the Bundys, that from my understanding, is they're a bunch of moochers, aren't they? Aren't they mooching off the government dime? I can't see how you can be a red-blooded patriot at the same time being a kind of parasite.
Well, they definitely don't see it that way.
Isn't that clear?
I mean, the Bundys are complicated. They're very conservative, reactionary, constitutionalist Mormons. And so their worldview is very, very, it's like a very theological libertarianism, messianic almost. So the whole thing, I'll start with the grazing rights and the mooching thing.
Right.
They don't see that as they don't see their refusal in Nevada to pay the grazing fees as mooching, and they don't see even the refusal to pay the fees as the center of the issue. What happened to the Bundys is they're from a Mormon community that was actually founded as a sort of communal utopian apocalyptic community of sharing that actually ironically shared all their property the late 19th century, when a number of these Mormon experimental communities were started in Bunkerville, Nevada. That community eventually failed, and now property is individually owned there and has been for over a century. But that's the community that they come from. It's a pretty isolated, very rural community. There used to be a lot of ranchers. Now there's none. Now there's only the Bundys. But it's in the same county as Las Vegas. And what happened in the early 1990s, is the desert tortoise was listed as an endangered species. And there's been a lot of development in the Mojave Desert. There's also every single U.S. Branch of the military has at least one enormous base, often like each of them the size of Rhode Island, and a lot of where the dirt biking had become really popular, and the population is really in danger. And but especially in that county, Las Vegas was exploding at that point in terms of development. So much money being poured into Las Vegas, and it was growing so fast. And this, paving over the desert had a huge impact on tortoises, but a deal was struck where basically Vegas could continue to expand if the county designated some kind of area as a special tortoise zone. That's the short story of it. Of course, it was took much more to work it out, and they picked this area where these ranchers were. There were 25 of them, I think, in that area at that time, and basically they put in, working with the federal government, because everybody's trying to enforce this federal regulation about the tortoise, they put in new grazing restrictions to try to make it more tortoise friendly. Because basically, the cows and the tortoise, to put it simply again, are competing for the same desert forage, which is scarce. It's a very dry space. So there was less grazing allowed during the spring green up when the desert has the most, succulent things to eat, and just generally less cows being allowed on the range. Most of the other ranchers there saw this as the final nail in the coffin of their business, because you need so much land. You need to be able to graze so much land to raise cows in the desert. And it was a fairly profitable business, I think, for a lot of people to begin with. So they took buyouts on their grazing rights and sold out. But one person in the end remained, and that was Cliven Bundy, because of his political theology, was able to find a section of the Constitution that he believes shows that the federal government cannot own land at all. So then he decided that the Bureau of Land Management had no right to tell him how to run his cows anyway. So that's when he stopped paying his fees. But to him, it's not about not paying the fees, because the fees are not extraordinarily high. It's about, if when I pay the fee, I recognize their authority, and I no longer recognize their authority in the state of Nevada. They even refer to Nevada as like the Republic of Nevada sometimes.
Well, we've only got about a minute, so I'm really going to have another conversation with you, Anthony, because there's so much more to talk about. But just if you could quickly end my puzzlement about why is it that people who are so remote from the problems that motivate them seem to be the most exercised and heavily armed.
If you talk about issues also of like demographic change and race and things like this and immigrants, the Bundys themselves, I think Ammon Bundy actually broke with his Patriot supporters over the issue of immigration this November when he got upset about how the Trump coordinated campaign in the 2018 congressional elections was all being focused on like terror about immigrants and the caravans, as you'll recall. And he went on social media and started criticizing his whole movement and criticizing Trump. He said Trump was basically like reminding him of Hitler, that it was our duty to welcome people coming from places, you know, people in need coming from countries where their lives were dangerous, offered to have refugees live, set up camps in his yard. And that resulted in a huge split between people like Ammon in the movement and people in that kind of patriot movement who are, I think it's fair to say, a little more oriented towards the militia, though not only, who have gone whole hog for Trump and are, you know, Trumpites all the way. We've seen definitely militia groups who are down at the border, like, taking it, self-deputizing themselves to detain migrants that happened in Salmon Park, New Mexico this spring. But Ammon, the Bundy side of things, has totally rejected that, which is another fascinating split. There's a whole, within that Bundy movement, there's a whole group of like extreme libertarians who are basically antinomians, right? They believe like, you know, God's law, and they see the Constitution as basically, you know, as guarantees of freedom and in this theological way, who some of them go to the point, not the Bundys believe in borders, but some of Bundy's allies even believe that borders should be open.
Well,
so
Anthony,
it's really complicated in that moment. You know, there's a lot of different strands of right-wing thought, and sometimes they came together as under Cliven and Ammon had a certain charismatic power over all the different strands, and I think at this point it seems to have crumbled a little bit, but we'll see.
Well, this just goes to show why people should get your book, the brand new book just out, Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff, because it is so much more complicated than the kind of superficial dismissal that we've had of these people tromping around with camo, wearing camo, carrying assault rifles. There's more to this story, and I thank you very much for joining us. And we'll do it again, Anthony.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthony McCann, who is a professor of creative writing at the California Institute of the Arts and the MFA program of the University of California, Riverside. He's the author of the poetry collections Thing Music, I Heart Your Fate, Moon Garden, and his latest book just out is Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loves.